In my life, growing up as a Christian has gone from deciding that I should get what I want, when I want it, to accepting reality from the loving hand of God.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In these weekly broadcasts of Christianity at Work, Jack and Christine will strive together in an extemporaneous dialogue to understand the practical issues, questions, and struggles of everyday life in the light of the truth of the gospel. Here now are Jack and Christine, continuing their series on biblical sexual ethics.
Jack, what we've said many, many times in the shows before this, in our series on sexuality, is that God created sexuality to be used as a language to communicate to my spouse that they're very special, that I treasure them, that I cherish them. I'm using your words. It's to ratify our marriage commitment to one another. It's to
celebrate it.
To celebrate it, to say, more than I love you, to say I'm committed to you. And to say it in a very beautiful and wonderful way.
Yeah.
But there's also another part of sexuality that just comes out of it naturally, and that's procreation. How does that fit into our sexuality?
There's a connection between procreation and sexuality that God has built into the nature of human sexuality, that it would be wrong for us to try to separate and divorce from it. It's kind of a rebellion against God's created order if we come before God and say, I really like this idea of sexuality and I want that to be a part of my experience, but procreation is kind of a hassle. I'm not interested in that. And that's a sort of evil rebellion against God if the attitude that we adopt toward our sexuality is that I want to somehow divorce it altogether from procreation.
Now, that's a big word to call that evil. Why do you bring up that?
Well, I think fundamentally the root of evil, in the root of sin in human experience, is a rebellion against reality, where we're hostile to the reality that God has created, or we try to recreate it, you know, either in our imagination or our fantasy or in the story that we tell one another. We keep lying to ourselves and live our lives pretending that reality is different from the way God has actually created it. And I think that's foundational to all sin and all evil.
Okay, let's get a couple of examples before we go on that doesn't have to do with this one on procreation.
Of evil, you mean?
Evil. In the form of not being willing to look at the reality that God created. What exactly are you meaning by that?
Well, we've been talking about marriage in recent weeks. Let's say that I'm a man who, out of my insecurity and my fear, I've just decided that I want to control my life by controlling my wife and my children. And so whatever I say is true. Whatever I say is real, is real. That's a fundamentally evil attitude. And it's evil because I am not interested in personally coming face to face with the reality of what is the case. If I don't want to ever acknowledge that I'm wrong, I don't want to ever acknowledge that I have done wrong, I don't want to acknowledge that I'm to blame for anything. So I spend the rest of my life manipulating my wife and the children into taking the blame for mistakes that I make and for being the bad guy, and I'm always the good guy.
So the
that's evil, I would argue.
The reality that you're talking about is his unwillingness to look at the reality of his own sin.
Right.
Personally.
Right.
Okay, but there's other realities that we don't want to look at also that go beyond just not wanting to look at ourselves and our own sin.
A fundamental one, I'm sure you can come up with some examples as well, but a fundamental one that you see in the Bible is the belief, the myth, the fairy tale that I was made for this world and therefore I should live my life pursuing whatever happiness and pleasure and satisfaction that I can get out of the things of this world, the material things of this world, the relationships of this world, the honor and fame and power that is to be gained in this world, that that's what my existence is all about and that's what I was made for. That's a lie. That's a fiction. That's not reality. And there are many, many people who spend their lives running away from the truth, which is, I was made for another age, for an age that is to come. And that's where I should invest my time and energy.
And using an example that we brought up just last week regarding sexuality again is, I think the way our culture has wanted to define sexuality is in terms of pleasure, eroticism.
Right.
And what I want to do is just have sex be something that brings me pleasure when I want it, with whom I want it, and not have it guided or harnessed by the reality of what God intended sexuality to be in our lives.
Yeah. I have a friend who's read a lot of science fiction. I don't read much, but I have a friend who's read a lot of science fiction, and he was explaining to me some of the themes that he finds in science fiction. It's really interesting that in science fiction, one of the things that they typically do is go to some other planet where they have a whole different role for sexuality in their life, in their civilization or whatever. And it just struck me as how interesting that here this literature is basically taking our fantasies and trying to work really hard to pretend like it could be that way, to pretend like this is what our sexuality could be and this is what it could be like. And that's what they do, is explore the possibility. What if sexuality were just for pleasure? What if sexuality had no complications like relationships involved in them? And I don't know what other themes they explore, but that's the impulse of the sinful human being, is to want to pretend that the world isn't the way the world is, that God didn't make it the way he made it.
And that we don't have to follow it according to his outline,
right,
of reality.
Right.
It's very difficult, though, Jack, to understand reality as our culture has so redefined it, that a lot of being a Christian has to do is figuring out what reality is about, which is tough unless you're really taking a close look at the scripture and really making that a serious project of your life.
Right. And that's why what I see happening in Christian culture today is alarming to me, is that we're becoming more and more biblically illiterate. We're not having our thinking and our attitudes and our perceptions of life grounded in what the Bible teaches. We're kind of ignoring the Bible. And that's a very alarming trend, because the messages of the media of our culture are so powerful and so seductive and so interesting to us that we're going to be seduced by them if we're not well grounded in the biblical worldview.
And also, Jack, there's a lot of mix between at least the language of our culture and the biblical language. We talk about loving each other, for example, as a very simple example. But people in the world will say, of course it's good to love each other. And the Bible says it's good to love each other, but we need to go further than that and understand what the Bible really means when it says love each other.
Yeah.
Forgiveness is another example. Forgiveness has been really distorted. What does the Bible mean by forgiveness, and what does our culture say can be very, very different.
Yeah.
But we're using the same words.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So what you were saying is that really the bottom line of evil, or the bottom line of sin, is rejecting reality that God made. I like you saying it that simply. I like hearing that, because that's exactly how, I mean, it's a very personal interest of mine, because that's exactly what I do as a counselor. I help people all the time look at the reality of their lives. And it's very difficult, because people have so twisted and turned how they see themselves, how they see other people, either through their woundedness or through their sin, and probably always a combination of the two. And so bottom line, I think that's what defines counseling for me, is helping people look at reality.
The way it really is.
Reality the way it really is.
Yeah.
It's a little redundant.
Yeah.
But okay.
But we need to say it these days.
I think so. But, you know, that's a tough task. It really is, to look at reality. So, Jack, how does all that have to do with the whole idea of procreation?
Well, that simply, if we look at the way God has made us anatomically, biologically, and so on, I think we can reasonably conclude that God intended procreation to be one of the aspects of human sexuality. You know, I've argued I hope forcefully, that procreation is not the primary function of human sexuality. That is, God did not make us sexual creatures merely in order to make little human creatures, and that that's its sole purpose and only purpose. That I think we have enough biblical evidence and our own human experience to teach us that it's a much more mysterious thing than just a way of reproducing. That is, it is this language whereby two people committed to each other can confirm their commitment to one another and celebrate that. That's what I've been arguing. And although that's the primary purpose of sexuality, it's not the only purpose. And a very important aspect of what God intends to happen is for procreation to happen through sexuality. It seems utterly appropriate to me. I mean, what better place, especially given the way God has made reproduction happen in human beings, where the child comes into the world utterly dependent and an utterly needy creature who could never survive on his or her own. Given that that's the case, what better environment to bring that child into than an environment of a committed relationship of two people who love one another, respect one another, care for one another, are kind to one another, and are committed to one another for life. I mean, the ideal of what God has set up here just seems absolutely wonderful to me. Obviously, the reality is not always that pleasant, but what God intended from the very beginning is very appropriate. So it makes a lot of sense that God would make procreation the outgrowth of this act whereby two people who are committed to one another are celebrating their commitment to one another. To make procreation the outcome of that act makes a whole lot of sense to me.
And a continuation of that act of oneness, where ideally they're working together to nurture, to raise, to care about another human being.
Right, right. Now, it seems to me, where I was going, though, is that it seems to me that it's a perversion to take that procreation and make that the primary purpose of sexuality. There are traditions that have done that. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think that's the mistake that Roman Catholic theology is making. They have decided that sex is all about procreation, and therefore, if we make sex about anything else in our marriage relationship, we are somehow sinning against God. And so we need to, one, not use any birth control that would prevent procreation, because that would be to rebel against God. And I'm not altogether unsympathetic with that. I will argue something similar. But furthermore, that sex would be inappropriate if my purpose and my goal and my desire is not procreation. That may be misrepresenting their position, but I think there are some people who have argued that. And I think that's a mistake, that in fact the Bible is saying that the purpose of sexuality is this language, and procreation may in fact happen. And I need to be prepared to accept from God the gift of a child. I need to give God the sovereign providential right to decide that it's time for me to take on the responsibility of raising and nurturing another human being. If I'm not ready and prepared to do that, then I really have no business being married and being in a sexual relationship with my spouse. That's just part of the package. That's part of what we are taking on when we enter into marriage. And I can't rebel against that. I can't say no to that. It's not really a valid, righteous option for me.
So when you say I cannot say no to that, are you saying that birth control doesn't have a place?
No, I'm not. And maybe I'm copping out here. I honestly worry about that sometimes, that maybe I'm just copping out. But it doesn't seem to follow to me that birth control is just inherently wrong. Because the issue is more my attitude than it is the technology of birth control. What I mean by that is, let me just give you an example. Let's say that my wife and I are using a birth control method and it fails. And fails in the sense of it fails to prevent conception and that we have a child. If my attitude toward that failure of the birth control method, if my attitude toward that is, a resounding rats.
God, how could you do this
God,
to me?
God, how could you do this to me? This is terrible. This is awful. Shame on you. You have no right to do this, shaking my fist at heaven, or something milder, but in that direction. Then my attitude was wrong. My purpose for using birth control was I wanted the joy and the delight and the pleasure of sexual relationship without the responsibility that might in fact ensue from that. And that's really not a righteous option for me. I always need to be ready and prepared to take whatever responsibility God grants me through this act and take on that responsibility and accept it. If, on the other hand, I really am able and willing to say, wow, this is wonderful. It's great that we're going to have another child. Even though I was trying to prevent it, I fully grant God the right to tell me when I will and will not have a child. Then I would argue that I think my attitude, my heart was in the right place, my attitude is right. I was simply trying to be responsible and wise in the best way that I knew how, given my reading of our situation, our circumstances, and God vetoed my decision. And who better to veto my decision than God? I mean, if I can take that attitude, then it seems to me that I am using birth control in a way that is not evil, that it's not irresponsible, it's not ungodly, and it's not rebellious. It's just, like anything else in life, as a finite human being, I'm trying to make my decisions the best I can about timing when I will take on a responsibility. I'm not asking the question, I'm not saying if we will have children or if we will take on this responsibility, but when. And I don't think that's inappropriate. We do that in all kinds of areas of our life. And I think that's just a part of what it means to be a human being and to function as a human being, is to try to judge and plan and be prudent and be responsible and organize our lives. Arrogance comes in when we decide that it's my prerogative to organize my life and God has no business butting in and interfering.
That's arrogance, and also bringing in what you said at the very beginning, that's really the bottom line of a rebellion against God.
Yes.
Trying to tie that together, what you're saying is that the reality is that God may bring in another child into my life, and that's the reality that he may want in my life. It's rebellion to say, absolutely no, I won't accept this from you, God.
Yeah.
And the absolutely no can go all the way from being very upset about it, or mildly upset about it, to actually aborting a child.
Right.
And I think abortion is the bottom line of rebellion against the reality of what God has brought into our life.
Yeah, exactly. We have to come to terms with how the real locus of evil in the human heart are all these seething attitudes down there, these attitudes of entitlement, of rights, of desire not to be inconvenienced or interfered with or have anything earth-shaking happen in my life. We want to be in control, and we think we have the right to be in control. The very opposite attitude of that, the attitude of a righteous, godly person who's come to terms with their true character as a creature made by their Creator, is one of acceptance of whatever it is that God brings into their life. And that's a really hard one. I mean, that virtue of, I think I've mentioned this before, the term that gets used in the New Testament is the Greek term sophrosune, that kind of resignation to my actual place in the cosmos as a creature that God has every right to create and every right to plan out my life and tell the story that he wants to tell through my life. If I can't finally come to that perspective on myself, then that's the heart of my rebellion against God. I think I'm bigger stuff than I really am. I think I'm more important than I am, if I feel that sense of entitlement. And that works itself out in abortion, in contraception, in just our attitudes, our everyday attitudes toward children coming into our life.
Oh, toward everything, Jack.
Yeah.
Really, I want to be the center. I want what I want when I want it. And I really do kind of feel entitled to get what I want. I remember, as an example, when I got pregnant with my first child, I have three children, and I had only been married maybe a year, year and a half, not very long, and we had been using contraceptive, and I I fully expected not to get pregnant yet. Was definitely planning to have children at some point, but just hadn't really come to the point of deciding that's what we were going to do now. So I all of a sudden found myself pregnant, and I went to work. I worked at a state agency at that time and was telling one of my coworkers about the fact that I was pregnant, and I was just kind of spinning and kind of confusion, and I hadn't really thought about it, and it was such a new thing, and I was just really caught off guard, very much so. We were in a new town with new jobs, and it just really caught me off guard. And she started talking to me about the possibility of abortion, just right up front, and it knocked me off my feet. It hadn't occurred to me that that's what I would do. I was just having to orient myself to something that was very big in my life and very sobering to me. But her answer immediately was, well, you know, I had she was saying that she had an abortion, so, you know, it worked out fine for me, and maybe you're not ready yet, and you can just do it later. That, I think, is the ultimate of trying to play God in my life and not accepting the reality of what God gave me, even though it was difficult for me at the time and I really wasn't yet prepared for it.
And abortion is such a horrible metaphor for the true nature of my sense of entitlement and desire not to be inconvenienced, because it's at the cost of a human life. And yet, that's true of all selfishness and self-centeredness, is that any self-centeredness basically is saying, I want what I want when I want it, and if somebody else needs to get smashed in the process, then so be it. And that's, you know, when you put it so starkly and in such a raw way, you know, it sounds horrible. But that's what abortion does, is put it right out there, the true nature of my selfishness. Sure, if somebody gets in the way, kill them. What's wrong with that? That's easy, isn't it? Oh, just how horrible that is. And yet, it just stands as a real metaphor for the nature of all selfishness and all self-centeredness.
It is. Jack, as we're talking, I'm realizing that here we have gone and stumbled into a very big topic that I hadn't thought that would come up today. But the whole area of abortion is very big. It's very tense. I wonder if you'd be willing to talk more about it.
You mean right now?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I have anything more to say.
Well, one of the things that occurs to me is that when you say abortion is the ultimate of rebellion against God, it's not wanting anything to get in my way, and if it does, I'll just murder them. Well, what we've done in our culture is redefined it from being a person to being a fetus.
Right.
And so in our culture we've said, therefore, I'm not really killing a person. It's not a person yet. It's only a fetus. Does the Bible say anything about that?
Well, not directly, because it wasn't really technologically a problem that they faced. So I think it would be a hard case to make passages directly address the question of abortion, biblical passages. But I guess, you know, a lot of these things, we've been talking around this, and I've been assuming this, but I maybe should make this explicit. There are certain things that we can know just because we can look at the world that God created and see its design and see its structure, and from its design and its structure, we can understand God's purposes. We're looking at nature. We're looking at natural law. We're looking at the natural order. The natural order tells us much about what God has purposed just by itself, without any scripture. All I have, just using my reason and my experience and my observation of nature, I can decide this is the way that it is. Now, the Bible, I think, invites me to do that, because it teaches a view of God as the creator and as a rational creator who created the natural order with a kind of rational order and a purposive structure. It invites me to see the world that way.
That way? I'm kind of vague. What are you saying? Give me an example.
It invites me to see the world as revealing to me the purposes of God, and to read off of natural law and the natural order, to read off of that what it is God intended.
Okay, so what comes to mind, let's see if I'm following you, is my garden up till about 2 weeks ago was pretty barren. And all of a sudden, my magnolias are pink and white and beautiful and bulging. And the camellias are full of flower. And every time I walk out there, there's more and more that's budding and flowering. The natural order is that there was death in the winter, or seeming death, and then life burst out in the spring.
That's a little bit more sophisticated, and that's more sophisticated than I have in mind. I think that that's probably true. It's certainly, nature is telling a story that it in miniature that is actually the story of the whole cosmos in large, and I think that's true.
Out of death comes life.
Yeah, but I actually have something even more simple than that in mind, and that is we've been talking about the relationship between sexuality and procreation. Well, can I find a Bible verse that says God has made procreation a part of sexuality, therefore what God has put together, let no man separate? No, I can't find a Bible verse that says that. But I don't have to be real bright to look at human anatomy, human physiology, human biology, and human experience, and realize, yep, sure enough, God intended sexuality and procreation to go together. That I'm drawing that conclusion not based on biblical revelation, but based on nature itself.
Okay,
the
so
way
what,
God has created the world.
What you're getting at then, Jack, is that there's a lot of things that the Bible doesn't talk about explicitly.
Right.
And we don't have the Bible as a handbook that tells us everything to do and think about everything in life. One of those things is abortion. One of those, it doesn't say in the Bible, for example, that when there's a baby in your womb, that it's a fetus or a baby.
Right.
And so what you're arguing is that there's just kind of a knowing that it's a baby?
Well, yeah, in this sense. If, you know, what legally what we've been trying to do in this country is say, let's draw a line, and before that line...
Before a certain amount of months.
Yeah.
After conception.
We will call it a fetus and not call it a human being and not give it legal rights and so on and so forth. And after that point, we will call it a human being that will be protected by our laws. Well, what's the logical place to draw that line? It seems to me that the logical place to draw that line, the reasonable, rational place to draw that line is if nobody interfered, if nobody did anything to intervene, would it or would it not be a human being one day? I mean, just think of this for a second. A six-month-old baby is not a fully self-sufficient human being yet. If we did not care for the baby, the baby would die, would not survive on its own. Are we going to say, therefore, it's not really a real human being, and we can do with it whatever we want to do with it? We could smash it to death if we wanted to. I would hope that we would all recognize that that's a horrible thought. And yet, logically, if we are going to draw the line on the basis of could they make it without me, then there's a whole lot of people in this world who we could smash to death, and rightly, by that line of reasoning. Am I making any sense?
Yes, you are. And that's what's been rather confusing to me in this whole abortion debate, which I'm showing my lack of knowledge here, but it's been astounding to me that at age, when a baby is still in the womb, that we can really, up almost until birth, legally kill this child.
Right.
And call it okay and say that it's our right and vehemently stand on that with a great deal of political backing to do that and social backing to do that.
And 20 seconds later.
20 seconds later. 1 second later.
Yeah.
If that doctor was to pull that baby out, you know, giving birth, and break its neck.
It'd be murder.
It would be murder.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I shake my baby after that, mm-hmm. it's murder.
Yeah.
Now, and rightly, it should be murder. The doctor did murder. I did murder that baby. And that's wrong, and it should be called wrong. But I don't I can't get why when it was in the womb, it wouldn't be called wrong.
That's my point, is that obviously nothing magical happens in the development of that child by simply entering into the world outside of the mother's womb. Nothing magical happens from its conception until 18 years old. It's a steady continuum, a process of developing into a full-fledged adult human being. There's no place to break that continuum logically. The only place to break that continuum logically is, do you have something that if you left it alone, it wouldn't develop into a human being? A sperm will not develop into a human being left alone. An egg will not develop into a human being left alone. A fertilized egg, left alone,
develops into a human being. Yeah.
So it just seems to me that clearly, logically, rationally, there's a very clear-cut place to draw the line between what is sanctified, what is has sanctity and what doesn't. And it's at the point of fertilization that you have an entity there, a being there, that's going to be a human being one day if we just leave it alone and do what we ought to do. And therefore it has some sanctity. Mm-hmm. That just seems to me clear as day to me. It comes back to our earlier discussion, but what is the nature of human evil? To look at reality as reasonable as it might be, and tell ourselves a different story. We lie to ourselves. So we say, well, let's just say that something doesn't become a human being until it comes out of the mother's womb. Let's just say that, okay? Well, it's pretty convenient, but it doesn't make any sense.
It's redefining reality so that it meets my own comfort.
Exactly, and my convenience and my...
Yeah.
Now, maybe you can address this. I said... my convenience. The argument on the other side is that that's to really minimize the trauma of children coming into the world for women, and we're not talking about convenience, we're talking about real trauma and have a heart jack.
I've just written that down. I said, what about the whole area of women having a right to her own body? What about women not being able to say, I want to have that trauma or I don't?
Mm-hmm.
That's really big in our culture. From my perspective, childbirth was an extreme trauma. And many women give birth, and it's a beautiful experience. And they love it, and they would like to do it over and over again. So there are people with kind of medium experiences. And my experience, quite honestly, all three times was really tough on me. I really, really struggled with childbirth itself. Not as much with the pregnancy. At least for the first two, I had pretty easy and pretty delightful pregnancies. I actually enjoyed them. My third pregnancy was a difficult one. But the childbirth was difficult in all three. And so I'm one of those people that if there was an argument that says I should not have to go through the trauma of childbirth, certainly would be me. But... you know, I just got to say, yeah, it is hard. Yeah, it is a trauma. But it's a human being inside me that I have the responsibility to take care of. Just as I had the responsibility to take care of my now 16-year-old, I had the responsibility of taking care of him when he was in my womb and when I gave birth to him. We're going back to that whole issue of, am I entitled to have what I want when I want it, how I want it for my own comfort? And, I would really, quite honestly, like my comfort. But what am I committed to is the question. Am I committed to just my own comfort? Or am I committed to something bigger than that? And that's what us as Christians have to really come to terms with. Am I committed to what God wants in my life, to accept the reality, as difficult as it may be? Or am I going to rebel against it? And it's not, Jack, just obviously in this situation where I have that choice to make. But I have it in many, many ways every day of my life, in very small ways and in very big ways. Am I just for my own comfort going to tell a lie? Am I just for my own comfort going to manipulate my husband to go my direction? Am I just for my own comfort going to pretend like I don't hear my child when they ask for something? Am I for my own comfort going to pursue what I want to pursue when I want to? And my answer has to be over and over again, no. I do want comfort, I can recognize that, but I want to pursue what God wants more for me, and sometimes there will be comfort in that, and very often there will be There won't be. In fact, there could be a lot of suffering. Am I willing to accept suffering from the hand of God? Big, big, huge question, and it really fits into this context. If having a child is giving me suffering, then that's okay, because what I want to do more than anything else is I want to grow up. I want to mature. I want to be a person that's following after God, not just following after Christine. I do think there are children that come into the world that don't have parents that are prepared to take care of them or that can take care of them. And I think that it's an act of courage for those parents to be willing to give their children up for adoption, to be cared for by people who have the resources, the loving resources to do that. And I'm not necessarily even talking about finances at all there. I think resources sounds that way, but I'm just talking about
The moral resources.
And there's a lot of people out there that want children that can raise them. And so I just don't think it's an argument at all for someone to say, I can't bring this child into the world because I'm not ready to take care of them. Okay, you're not ready to take care of them. Then find one of a million other people who is and would delight in taking care of that child. I know I'm kind of going on a monologue here, but it brings to mind a very poignant pictures in my mind, though, when I say that. I've worked with many women who have given up their children for, you know, in adoption. And one time I worked with a pregnancy center that helped women do that. And those women just went through the most agony of going through the whole process of being pregnant, and then holding that child for just a very short time and then handing them off to another person. Just the agony of anticipating that, the agony of giving the child away, the agony of years and years to come. It's not something they can take off. It's not like a shirt they can unbutton give away and not think about it again. It can't be replaced. It's always there. A person can say, well, would God want me to go through that suffering? Well, I think that God gives suffering in our lives to grow us up, to help us see reality, to help us mature. And this is a huge situation that is presented for a young woman to deal with the rest of her life. There's also a lot of people that I worked with that wouldn't allow themselves, women that wouldn't allow themselves to know that they were pregnant or to think about the process or even to be present in the birth process. And it wasn't until years later, perhaps, that all of a sudden it struck them that they had a child out there and that they didn't know it, they could never see it, and they were hit with the agony of that loss. You just cannot get away from it.
Based on your experience, do you think that sometimes young, single women who are pregnant don't consider seriously enough keeping the child? Do you think there's a place for such a woman to keep a child rather than give it up to adoption? Or would you pretty much automatically see adoption as the best option?
Oh, I think it's very individual.
Okay.
Very individual. I was just putting that out as there is certainly a possibility of places for the child to go if you're not ready for it, or if you don't have the moral or loving or whatever resources that a child really needs. And I think we really need to take that seriously. I know we need to take that seriously. What a child needs is so big, is so much. A younger person, I think particularly based on the support that they have around them, could be a parent to that child and could legitimately keep the child. But the support of people that can help them in many ways, because this, if it's a very young woman that's having the child, or a young girl, maybe a 16-year-old, she's going to have a lot of growing up to do herself, a lot of parenting that she still needs. And if she's willing to put herself, I guess, and submit herself to that reality and seek the kind of parenting she needs to grow up in order to nurture that child, it makes all the sense in the world to me that she could keep the child. But with sober.
Yeah.
Soberness.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's not a word.
Sobriety. That's what has struck me, is that it seems to me that a voice that I hear in the Christian culture at times is almost that you would be wrong not to give the child up for adoption if you're in that situation. I mean, we're against abortion, but we seem to almost be against, you know, vehemently against
keeping the
child being kept as well. And that's always struck me as odd because, again, going back to reading natural law, our own emotions, the connection that a pregnant woman makes with that child and so on, it seems to me that adoption is itself a kind of evil. It's a necessary evil, so don't misunderstand me here. I think it's the wisest choice people can make at times. But it is a transgression of the biological laws, the natural laws, where a woman feels the instinctual need to nurture the child that she has born. And if it's at all possible for that mother to raise that child, I think it's better for the mother, I think it's better for the child, and it's the most natural way to go. It's the way that God intended things to happen.
But I think what hangs us up a lot with Christian women, at least lots that I've worked with, is that there's a great deal of shame, of course, involved in having become pregnant. For many of these girls, they've really been involved perhaps in their church or been very, very much seen as an upstanding Christian in the community, and all this, you know, there's things happening behind closed doors that nobody else knows about, or maybe it was just an act of passion one time, who knows, but I've worked with both people, and anyway, the result is they're very, very ashamed, and so they want to hide it as quickly as they can, and I think it's a very sad thing that those people don't even consider keeping the child. They're just trying to get rid of the problem. The reality is they can't get rid of the problem. And that's very much the same as abortion. Once you have conceived, you have a child, and you can pretend as though you didn't have a child that you didn't give birth to, or that you gave birth to, or you didn't have a child that you aborted. But the fact is you do. And I can't tell you how many women that have come back to me years later thinking that it has not been a problem and come back and say, I didn't ever consider keeping my child and I'm devastated. Mm-hmm. I was just too ashamed. And many women who come back to me and say, I didn't think anything of the abortion at the time, but I killed my child. And they suffer very deeply.
Well, I guess that's what I'm saying, is that it seems we get too cavalier when we try to reinvent God's universe by saying adoption is a solution or abortion is a solution. There have to be emotional, psychological connections, and that's what you're saying is the case,
yes,
that run very, very deep, and we're transgressing those. And to transgress those lightly just seems to me a huge mistake. That the first option needs to be to assess my situation. Do I have the support? Do I have the commitment? Do I have the resolve to be a good parent to this child? And however much it's changed my life away from what I had hoped and dreamed, this is the life that God has given me now, and am I willing to take it on and just do right by this other human being, this child? It seems to me that's the wise, godly, righteous, obedient response. There comes a point where I can't make that commitment. I'm not able to make that commitment. I don't have the maturity, the wisdom, the moral resources, the psychological resources to do that. And then I think adoption is a viable option.
And again, I want to add to that, those resources is that the emotional and personal support,
right,
of other people, which is
right,
very, very, very key here.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Doing that by yourself, saying I have the commitment and saying I have it by myself, I think is quite honestly a ridiculous notion.
And unfortunately, people are often having to make that decision when they are too immature to be able to make that decision too.
Yeah. And so often doing it alone without anybody else knowing or being part of the decision, or people that are invested in nobody else knowing, like people I've worked with whose parents are, for example, Christian leaders in the community, perhaps pastors, often will just get their children into an abortion clinic really quickly or send them off to a place far away when they're pregnant very quickly. So they're not invested in what's best for my child, but how can I look okay, which is a tragedy.
Yeah.
And I hear it a lot, Jack. It's It doesn't just happen every once in a while. It just happens a whole lot.
Well, let's talk about that, because that is crucial. I mean, that's horrible, the fact that the Christian community supposedly is the champion of life, pro-life and the sanctity of life, and yet we will change our mind in a flash in order to avoid shame. You know, what should they be doing instead?
They should face into it.
Right? In a very public way.
Yeah. I think we don't face into a lot of stuff is because, lots of reasons, but one is our misunderstanding of our faith. Our misunderstanding is that we're supposed to have it all together once we become a Christian.
I came to Jesus and now I don't do wrong anymore.
Yeah, and what they don't understand, I think, at a very deep and profound level, is that I came to Jesus and I recognized that I was a sinner. And that the miracle is that I can see that I'm a sinner. And out of that recognition, out of that seeing that reality so clearly, that I turn to the cross and I say, I needed that. I do need that, and I will continue to need that, and I'll look forward to a day in heaven when God takes away all sin. But at this point, as in life, that's always going to be what I struggle with, is my own evil.
Yeah, I think that's the pressure that pastors feel, is because they have misrepresented and misconstrued the gospel themselves, they feel like it would be hypocritical for them to acknowledge failure at the same time that they are proclaiming the gospel, because their view of the gospel is Jesus comes into my life and makes me powerful against temptation now. And so whether it's my failure or my children's failure, we feel like we need to hide it for the sake of the gospel or something like that, which is exactly the opposite. Because the truth of the gospel is that I, as a pastor, stand before you as a sinner, as an evil person who is capable of horrendously evil things. And I could stand up and say, see, this proves it. Look what I have done. Or look how my family has failed. Or look at how sin has ravaged my own family. That's reality, folks. That's human existence. That's human experience. And let's all look at it together. And what's the good news? The good news is that's not going to keep us from having an inheritance in the kingdom of God, because God has had mercy on us. And that's what the cross of Jesus is all about.
Yeah,
there's no contradiction there.
Bottom line, we don't understand mercy. We don't understand God's grace. That's the whole point of it, is we see that we're sinners and we recognize our need for His grace. Let me tell you a story that really fits into what you were saying. Last year, we were giving some teaching at the McKinsey Study Center. You were there, I believe, and talking about, I think, sexuality or parenting or something. Anyway, my husband was there speaking, and he was talking about how some mistakes that he was making with our children. And a phrase he used was, this is the way I think parenting should be, or whatever subject he was talking about, but I am a miserable failure. And not saying that cavalierly, but saying that with regret and wanting just to be open about the fact that he does fail. Soon after that, I had a woman that came and talked to me, and she said that one of the reasons she was willing to come in to counseling to talk to me is because she had heard my husband say he was a miserable failure. And she knew that she could honestly walk into my door and I would see her miserable failings, and she would not have to hide, as she had hidden from so many other people her whole life. Hmm. It was her ticket to freedom. Not freedom to sin, but freedom to look at reality.
Yeah.
The reality of her life. And she has done that with great resolve. And she goes back to that thing that my husband said over and over again and says, I wish I had heard that. I wish I had heard that. Hmm. I wouldn't be in the place I was perhaps now.
Yeah, well, we have another series coming up where we'll talk more and more and more about this, but it's absolutely essential that we come to a clear and accurate and profound understanding of what the Christian faith really is all about, because we have seriously distorted it at times to our own destruction and to our own bondage and slavery.
Yeah, well, just following up on that, we do, I think, plan next to talk about what does it look like to be a Christian. And we have a lot to cover. A lot of what I thought in the beginning of my Christian life has changed over time, and as I've matured and understand the scripture more and more.
The ministry of Mackenzie Study Center is founded on a passionate desire to confront the truth of the gospel. Over the years, Mackenzie has offered classes, seminars, tutorials, counseling, conferences, and more to interested individuals. The staff at Mackenzie also write and offer to you the free monthly newsletter, News and Views. You might want to check out the News and Views titled, Bible Study for What Ails Us by Dr. Jack Crabtree. Jack takes on the popular sentiment that says being a Christian is just about loving Jesus and not about believing the right doctrine. Jack argues that although knowing the right doctrine is not enough to secure one's salvation, turning away from the pursuit of truth will lead one down the path of false spirituality. He says, from a human perspective, the only way any of us is going to survive is by grounding ourselves in the truth. The best way we can become grounded in the truth is by becoming grounded in the teaching of the Bible. And the only way we can become grounded in the teaching of the Bible is by making its study a priority. Call Mackenzie Study Center and get your copy of Bible Study for What Ails Us. The phone number is 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801. Now, back to Jack and Christine.
Oh man, Jack, did we roll into a difficult subject this time. We found ourselves right smack in the middle of talking about abortion and birth control. Bottom line, what I got from it is that the reason we may abort, the reason that we may be unwilling to accept a child from God, is our rebellion against Him. We want to be gods. We want what we want when we want it. And we don't want to have to submit ourselves to what God wants in our lives. So if, for example, I am using birth control and I end up getting pregnant anyway, I might curse God, I might be angry at God, I might abort a child, because it just isn't in my plan. And I don't want to have to submit myself to what God has planned in my life.
The vision for who we are as human beings and therefore how we are to conduct ourselves in this life that you were espousing, for example, is incredibly demanding and alien to our natural normal tendencies. The idea that we would actually think that my being out of control of my life and experience and being inconvenienced by the things that come down my path and accept that somehow and just take it in stride and make it a part of my life without balking at it, without rebelling against it. It's just so alien to our natural way of thinking. It's quite understandable that the world around us does not want to live that way and cannot even understand how we would even think of that as a possibility. But for those of us who are Christians, this is a radically new and different, a starkly alien way of living life. But we of all people should be the people who have a view of reality that allows us to live that way. And as you said during the program, not just on big issues like abortion, but the everyday mundane little issues of, am I going to exaggerate here? Am I going to lie here? And am I going to manipulate here? Am I going to coerce here? Am I going to intimidate here? Just because I want what I want when I want it? Or am I going to do the right thing and take whatever comes? As children of God, we have to get to a point where we're willing to just do the right thing because it's right and then take whatever comes.
And what you said to me many years ago, it isn't around suffering that we grow up, but it's in and through our willingness to suffer that we grow up, that we mature.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.